Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of Institutional Advisors.
Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Chris, and also with your listeners.
Well, it's great to have you back. And, you know, you just issued an advisory here. It says global warning exclamation point issued yesterday, October 4th. You say credit spreads are giving you some of the most ominous signs in years. Please tell us more.
Everybody watches the stock market. That's the big item. And in financial bubbles, of which we are in another one now, it's the stock market gets the attention. But underneath it, there's a whole lot of really interesting stuff going on. So what you have is the street generally analyzes the stock market. It looks at companies and balance sheets and earnings statements. And then it figures the Fed's going to look after everything. So I'm all looked after on the equity side. But, you know, even the very best of companies throughout history, and you look back at a runaway financial market, and then comes the hit, and the best of the companies go down as well. So we're looking at things that overwhelm corporate abilities. Then the next stage is you want to look at things that overwhelm the ambition of central bankers. And so you look underneath it all, and yes, central bankers can push interest rates down for a while. They used to just push at the short end, but now they've been pushing at the long end by buying bonds. Our contention is that when a credit market is ready to change, like back in 2009, it was ready to change for the good, and it's been on since. So now it's ready to change, let's call it, for the bad. So, and you look at it through the yield curve, which is the difference between long-term yields and short-term in one instrument like treasuries. And you look back in history, and the Federal Reserve has little control over that market when it's ready to change. And then you look at credit spreads, and that's the difference between high-grade instruments and low-grade ones. And again, that one, there's no, when it's ready to change, the Fed's got no power at all. So, and then there's one other, which I didn't put in that report yesterday, was real long interest rates, where you take the long yield and adjust it for the rate of CPI inflation, and they don't have any control over that one. So this is why we focus on these. So you see Wall Street all the time saying, oh, what the Fed is doing is great, or it should do this, or it should be a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And it doesn't actually condemn the Fed as being ineffectual when the time comes for change. So the one we're looking at here is that in a few weeks ago, no, actually months ago now, the LIBOR rate started to increase, and it has increased enough to kind of shake the stock markets a little, but not yet a breakout. And then the one we did yesterday, that thing is getting ready to do a more serious move. So, you know, it's sort of underneath the markets, and it's not totally invisible because you had a whole lot of investment funds that are fixed income sector. But the one we did yesterday was on the credit spreads, which is, to repeat, the difference between high-grade bonds and low-grade bonds. And, of course, this made an important change in 2015 when the price of crude started going down, and you had then about 18% of junk bond issues were in the oil patch. So then they were directly affected, and then, of course, you get the spread out from other things as it heads down. So you had spreads on, we're looking at the CCC high-yield instrument against treasuries, and it got out to 20% in last January when the panic was really on, and that was a very huge widening of spread. So you'd expect a rebound out, which is what we got, once the panic was over. And then you'd expect there's a good seasonal in this instrument, Chris, and it goes, you get narrowing into around June or July, which we got, and then it was moving strong enough that we thought, well, let's put some technical research on it. We looked at other periods of narrowing credit spreads, and we used the momentum thing on it, the RSI, and we wanted it to come into around 25, because that was an important turning point on previous setups. So anyways, yeah, so as of yesterday, it was into 26, and then there's that's the momentum. And then on the other one, we have a different technical tool called a sequential. It's a pattern when you get certain ups and downs over, in this case, 13 weeks. So we got now a sequential buy on credit spreads, which means widening, which means upsetting to the financial market. So this narrowing, which is party time, what needed last week was, on this one, was to have the have that credit spread continue to narrow for a bit, which it has done now, and that then locked in the sequential buy on it. So this one is fascinating to watch. It's very powerful stuff when it turns, and the central bankers have no power over it. So we'll just watch for this one to turn. And every day we'll check the LIBOR rate. It got out to 0.866 a month ago, and it corrected into 0.83. These are not large numbers, Chris, that we're talking about, but it's the important things is the turn, and now it's at 8.6. So if the LIBOR goes above, let's say, 0.87, then we're in trouble. The other one that backs us up, and I referred to it in thing, is we did one of these global warnings, not warnings. It was October 17th in 2007 where similar changes were developing, and the high for the S&P, I think, was, what was it, October the 12th or something. So we came out with the global warning, and one of the things that we like to do is, of course, we specialize in precious metals as well, and we found decades ago that the gold-silver ratio is very good at anticipating changes in the credit markets. As a matter of fact, we've called it the metallic credit spread, because when you're in good times or in a boom and you've got a rally going on for precious metals, silver will outperform gold. So you keep track of that ratio, and when you're heading for a high in here, or a while ago, the momentum on the silver-gold ratio will get up, and we use the daily RSI on that one, and if it gets sort of up above 80, that's dangerous territory. It shows a lot of speculation. So this one, we got that a month or so ago, and then more recently in, what was it, August, we got an outright sell on the gold stocks. So, and we were looking for a 20% plus decline in the general gold stocks, maybe accomplished by the end of September. And then last week, we updated it and looked at the charts, and we're not yet into a buying territory on this. It's not oversold enough yet. So the gold and silver stocks have further to decline. But to get back to the gold-silver ratio, now it sets a low with an investment boom, and that was a while ago, but we were looking at it recently here, and it had to break out above 70, and on Tuesday, I guess it was, yeah, it did. It's broken out. So now what we look at in the gold-silver ratio is that it's saying a heads up. It's an alert to changes in the credit market. And then, of course, this is what we mentioned in April of 2007. Sorry, that was in October 2007. was that we had the turn in the credit spreads, just beginning, and we also had the breakout in the gold-silver ratio, and a warning for us, of course, that indeed did turn out to be the top of the stock market. And then here we are now. You had, if you look at the New York Composite Index, NYA, it set its high, I think, September the 6th. You also had the, and that was, it just released last week, with this week was the consumer confidence sentiment reading by the conference board. And it was at the highest since August 2007. So there's a lot of positives on consumer confidence and on the general stock market. But inside, for example, just this week now, you've had the New York Advanced Decline Index on the New York Stock Exchange. It's beginning to roll over, so the breadth of the market is changing. So, Chris, that's what we're looking for, is change, and the change is coming in on the credit markets with the yield curve. Oh, yeah, I didn't mention that. I would update it. Yeah, it made an important reversal a month and a half ago, and it's corrected back, and then as of this week, it's starting to head in the bad way again. So you've got the yield curve, credit spreads are changing to a warning on the overall party that's going on.
One of the top stories we haven't addressed yet last week was clearly the FOMC meeting. It looks like we will more than likely have a rate hike as soon as December, which could take us to 75 basis points on the overnight lending rate. The Fed Funds future is predicting pretty solid odds after the 2016 presidential elections. We're looking for more than likely a rate hike, at least December or 2017. Any comments on how might that impact the market?
Not that the Fed policy is going to impact the market. It's that the these changes in the credit markets that are going on now will impact the Fed. It'll force them to follow up and raise rates, which will not be helping things. But then this is where the interesting thing will be, is how do they explain raising rates in a disaster? So, no, if you take the history of the senior central bank, which now is the Federal Reserve and it used to be the Bank of England, at major changes in financial markets, like big changes from the bottom of a crash or the top of a bubble, changes in the administered rate of the central bank have been 4 or 5 months behind changes in market rates. So this is where it gets a little ironical, is that a whole lot of Fed watchers really think that Fed's running the thing. So they're making a living discussing what the Fed might do, ought to do, or should, when actually the Fed's following market forces.
But, you know, we do have to look at the core inflation rate, which is getting very close to their 2% target. Of course, that's what they've at least mentioned in previous meeting minutes. Starting to show some signs of price increases, as one would expect. But I think you make an interesting point. Many of our guests take your stance and agree with you that is almost the tail wagging the dog. I wanted to move on, if we could, to another interesting topic. Seems to be on everybody's radar lately, and that's Deutsche Bank. This collapsing share price, not to mention the Justice Department fine, has one of Europe's most prominent lending institutions in the strongest economy within Europe. It has a lot of people concerned that we could see another maybe Bear Stearns / Lehman Brothers style 2008-2009 credit fueled meltdown. I'd like your thoughts on Deutsche Bank, whether or not you think their balance sheet is likely riddled, as are our money center banks here in the U.S., with toxic derivatives, mortgage-backed securities, CDSs, and CDOs?
Well, I haven't looked in detail at their balance sheet. All I know is that they're in a severe contraction. They were very aggressive in the financial markets, in creating instruments and leveraging them and all that sort of stuff. Then also, and I don't think anybody fully understands the issue that the U.S. has against Deutsche Bank. But all they wanted to do was grab $15 billion. These shouldn't be looked at as penalties or fines for misdeeds, because I don't think they can really identify the misdeed. This is just straight robber barons grabbing money. So then when the stock was selling off sharply a month ago, they met back, and then they came up with this $5.4 billion number, which happened to be the amount of money that they had in one reserve in their accounting or something or other. So they said, oh, well, we'll be happy with that. So this is just straight robber barons. It's evil. But then on the other hand, you have a very large financial institution that has been acting recklessly, and the market is putting their stock down until recently. So, yes, as regarding going back to 2008, it was June, when it was discovered that Bear Stearns had a problem. Then they took the hit, and the Fed, of course, became very aggressive, and it thought that that was it. And this is where the concept of the lender of last resort fell apart completely, because the lender of last resort idea is that if you fix one bank, and then nothing will spread. But the guys who dreamt up the idea never really fully understood that in a bubble, all lending institutions get offside, or let's say 99% of them do, because it's a birds flocking together situation. So, yes, you have a very important financial institution that is contracting. I don't see anything that would stop the contraction or turn it around and get them expanding again, because people have become wary and taking their deposits or their business elsewhere. 1931, when the markets had rebounded out of the first crash, and then you had Credit Anstalt in Austria, which was a very big bank in Europe, and it was discovered to have a problem. But there was more to it than just Credit Anstalt, because in the first hit in 1929 and into 1930, the authorities in Austria forced Credit Anstalt to help out some other banks. They might have wanted to protect their balance sheet, but they were forced to. So then it was May 1931 when it was discovered that it was hopeless. So that then put the next leg down to the series crash right down into 1932. Yes, one bank getting into trouble is important. It'll be another test of whether the authorities can keep it at just one bank. But the problem is that any number of lending institutions have become aggressive. And then the other thing that's being now fully understood is that the zero interest rate nonsense is really harming commercial banks and insurance companies. It is really harmful. But it's interesting to look back on it, because it is a major flaw in the concept of intervention. And their idea is that if you do something flick like now, like kicking a football, then it changes everything.
You're talking about the mechanics and science of chaos theory and complexity theory. They fail to recognize that the butterfly flapping its wings in Singapore, right, can cause a hurricane, perhaps in the Gulf of Mexico. I.e., we're not always certain of the implications and reverberations of the seemingly subtle policymaker action.
Now, you see, in 09... they recovered. The panic was over. The expansion started, but it was never enough for them arbitrarily. So then they keep punting. They can't leave well enough alone. This is what I guess I'm trying to say. So the hit, like the sharp drop in rates, and then a big hit of QE, was supposed to create strong economic growth. It hadn't. It hasn't.
Because the framework, the foundation that was in place in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even part of the 80s, has been eroded to such a point. It really is the proverbial pushing on a string. I think it's best illustrated by the fact that we've had interest rates at zero or NERP or near zero or now below zero. It's Sweden, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and 3.75% negative rates with the People's Bank of China. The fact that we've held rates so low for so long, and we haven't had the economic boom that you're referring to.
Yeah, well, also part of the problem beyond being in a post-bubble contraction is that there's so many rules and regulations put into business and commerce and industry that it's constrained. But then you got another set of guys at the central bank who arbitrarily decide growth isn't strong enough. And they've got this theory that if they add more credit, it'll add growth, and it isn't working. But now they are finally to the point, and Deutsche Bank is one telltale here, and there are other, at this point, nameless insurance companies, and whether casualty or life or whatever, that are in an impossible situation. So the what was considered as good has run so long that it has now become bad, and the system will change. And again, it's looking at the ancient old credit spreads, yield curve, and they're beginning to change in the direction that says watch out. So. But what I've been writing on a bigger picture stuff is that a recession is inevitable. A bear market from a bubble is inevitable. Perhaps it's starting. But even without that is that with the inevitability, you will then have a condition where the average taxpayer is going to look at things and say, look it, you spent trillions of our dollars on our risk pushing your theories. So I think that the central banks will be reformed not from within but by a pissed off electorate and taxpayer who's saying it's not working. And from time to time, there's a lot of common sense within the public, and all it is revealing is that there's never been any common sense in the concept of interventionist central banking. We do live in interesting times, Chris. Started off by saying that they're getting successful at getting inflation up to 2%, and they've been frustrated with this. Now, I started in the business in '63 with the premier investment dealer in Canada. I mean, this was like Goldman Sachs with integrity. So then I was in the research department in the head office in Toronto at 65, and that's when inflation was getting worrying. CPI inflation was getting up to 1% or something like that. So I was new to the bond market and thought, I ended up talking with the senior vice president of bonds, who was then an elderly man, but he'd had a full career in the bond market. So I said, "Isn't this a concern? Because you're the threat to the principal, and you have the threat to the amount of income you're getting." And he says, "Oh, it is," but he said, "Serious inflation only happens in lesser countries, such as in Europe or in South America, but never in Canada, the United States, or England."
We just got a call opening up the digital mailbag.
John here, now residing in sunny San Diego. You know, all the big news lately is Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Bank. Of course, we knew they were in trouble a long time ago, but maybe one of your guests could draw the parallel between the Kreditanstalt, which failed about 1930 and brought down just about every European bank there was in the wake of its collapse. This looks like it's setting up to be another Kreditanstalt. And imagine, that was back in the 1930s before they had the internet. It's getting very interesting. I think we're going to have a very interesting October, don't you? Maybe Deutsche Bank will be the catalyst to finally break the stranglehold that the bullion bankers have on gold and silver. Keep up the good work.
We have John from San Diego. He's a regular listener and a prolific caller. He draws parallels between the current Deutsche Bank fiasco and the Kreditanstalt, I believe, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, of the 1930s, which he claims brought down many, if not most, of the major European banks.
And they had been forced to bail out a lesser bank, which impaired their balance sheet, so that then when credit markets began to change, I guess, May of 1931, all of a sudden, they were gone. It should be considered, it wasn't that Kreditanstalt caused the severe contraction. The severe contraction was on, and Kreditanstalt was the big name that failed. So here you have early stages of a credit contraction, and at the moment, the Deutsche Bank happens to be the big name. There'd be all kinds of smaller or lesser or even moderate-sized names that you and I can't know about, sort of waiting in the wings. So this will be a serious condemnation of the central bank concept of the lender to last resort, where they come in and fix one, then there's no problem. But the problem is that in a boom, 90% of the lending agencies get ambitious and get into troubles. And that's human nature's way. It's been that way. You read about mortgage market collapse in Rome, in ancient Rome. Cicero writes that where there was important commercial and financial center there, Cicero writes that if there is a problem in the remote provinces, that financial problem will eventually hit in Rome. And that's the way it works. So here you now, New York is the financial center of the world. London is right up there close to it now. And you've got a problem in Germany, which is an important country. Anyways, there may be a problem suddenly come out of China or Asia. So I think a serious contraction is unavoidable.
Thank you, John, for another very interesting comment and question. Maybe shift the dialogue really back to the precious metals. I think your assessment was right. Obviously, we've been watching multi-week consolidation. There's plenty of downside risk on the XAU in the near term, and we haven't even reached the 200-day moving average yet on the weekly charts for either gold or the XAU. Some wiggle room there. We're expecting continued buying opportunities, though, because some of our favorite sentiment indexes, despite the fact that we were overbought and in need of a correction, are still registering, you might say, stubbornly strong and robust momentum readings, suggests the bull market may remain intact despite the sell-off.
Our advice in early August was that it would be the first significant correction in what is otherwise a new bull market for gold that began, you know, January, let's say. You know, it took a while to get everything sorted out. But, yeah, this is a cyclical bull market for precious metals. And it'll be mainly due to the price of gold advancing relative to the cost of mining. It won't be due to gold going to $5,000 or $10,000. There's actually no rational way that one can come up with a $10,000 gold target. It's
I think there's confusion because there are those who haven't done the due diligence that have taken credit, if you will, for these pie in the sky numbers. And you're right. It sells newsletters. In this case, it'd be sensationalism. Nevertheless, there is some interesting work in this area by solid researchers like yourself, one of whom, Nick Barisha. But his analysis is very compelling for the case for $10,000 gold. Of course, he published a well-received book, $10,000 gold, about to publish a follow-up to that as well. He looks at the allocation, or I should say lack of allocation, to the precious metals throughout the world's pension funds. Okay, so let's say there's $4 trillion in pension funds in Tokyo, a trillion or two in China, and in Europe and the United States. And he's recognized that there's virtually none, maybe a quarter of 1%. It's a negligible, not even fractional number. If we were to even return to some semblance of the norm in the allocation there for a balanced portfolio, you would be looking at a minimum target of $10,000 gold.
Yeah, but I've found trying to analyze supply demand and go to price is at best guesswork. But let's just go through the historical way that I've done it, whereby in each post-bubble contraction, you get the real or deflated price of gold goes up for about 20 years. And the gold mining then becomes the premier industry. So let's say the real price over the next decade doubles. You know, all these marginal producers are going to make money like you wouldn't believe. So who cares for a target of 10,000 when all you need to know is that it's going to be the premier industry for investment, and then at highs, like let's call them intermediate highs, you're going to have some really good speculative action. That's all you need to know, that this is the best game in town. It's correcting now, and next year it'll be back to being the best game in town again.
What I think is really key here is for folks not to get too discouraged. We don't see any signs of a resumption of a bear market, but the ascent, you know, the rebound from the lows were awfully vertical.
Yeah, the XAU go from 99 to 280.
I think that's the HUI.
HUI was absolutely outstanding. And then there were some Midland-sized ones that, absolutely fantastic. Some of the silver stock, Majestic Silver, these were fabulous. The thing to do is to play the stocks. Now, our technical work, which gave us the high recently, I think it was the 1st of July, also is designed where we have an upside exhaustion on that model. It gives us a downside capitulation when the intermediate low is coming in. Then also we have a pattern. It's not based upon momentum, but it gives us, like in the summer, a sequential sell. So then at lows, it gives a sequential buy. So we have two tools for lightening up, and then another, then the same tool and same technical tools give us the time and the opportunity when it's time to add to your portfolio. So, and this actually worked for us back in 2011. Then this one, that was the silver gold ratio. The RSI on that got up to 92, and the only, and we were very careful to point out, the only other time in history that you had it up to 92 was January 1980 on that huge high. And we called for a cyclical bear market. There were some good trades in it, definitely good trades. And then it was November last year when we sat down and said, look, we're getting the opposites to what we had in 2011, and sat down and built a case for getting back into the market on lows perhaps around Christmas or into January. And it did work out. I think the low was late January, but, and it was nervous getting in, as any of these things are. So, but the correction in gold stocks has further to go, but it is a correction within a cyclical bull market.
Bob Hoy, we'd certainly like to know more about institutional advisors, the services we can expect to find, how we can sign up.
Look at institutionaladvisors.com. A quicker way is just to Google my name, Bob Hoy, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E. And you get into our site, and there's all the archival stuff. There's provocative essays on markets or central banks or even climate change, of all things. So yeah, it's an interesting place to hang out for a little while, and we'd welcome trial subscriptions.
Very good. Thank you, Bob Hoy.
Anytime, Chris. Look forward to the next one.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. We'll be right back.